us every Sunday of the year, and the group of people behind me are part of that, not the entire worship team, but I would love it if you would acknowledge them this morning with your applause, thanking them for their good work. Well, this past year in our congregation, actually the past fall, we, as a church, have been involved in something called the Community Bible Reading Experience, shortened to CBE. And this was a daunting task, as in October, our leadership put before the church the idea of reading through the entirety of the New Testament in 9 weeks. 9 weeks. That's tough enough to do in a year with these read-through-the-New-Testament kind of guides. But we felt it was a valuable experience to keep with a theme that we've actually been talking about for a year and a half. And that is trying to get above the minutiae of the Bible and see some of the larger themes. To get up at the 20,000-foot level, if you will, a bird's-eye view. And reading through the New Testament, we didn't read all four Gospels in a row, as they are listed in most of our Bibles. The editors of this special version of the New Testament did something very unique, and they spread the Gospels out through the entirety of the reading of the New Testament. The beginning of this particular edited Bible was the book of Luke, the account where much of our understanding of Jesus' birth comes from, because as you know, it's only mentioned in two of the Gospels, Matthew and Luke. So we read Luke first and got the full perspective on Jesus' life, and then we immediately went into the book of Acts, and it's sometimes called the Acts of the Apostles. It is the beginnings of what we enjoy today as the Christian church throughout the world. That is recorded in the book of Acts. And so I think it was brilliant on the part of the editors to start this New Testament by giving us the full history in context. Then we began to read the letters of the various apostles, and the other three gospel accounts are placed in the middle of those, as I said. One of the main themes that we discovered, especially from the gospels, is they claim to be eyewitness accounts. And I've chosen two this morning that I want to show on the screens. The first one is from Luke chapter 1. The second one will be from the book of John at the end of it. And I'm calling these bookend texts because they show the historical testimony of both Luke and the apostle John. Their desire was to pass on what they had seen, what they had learned and experienced from being with Jesus. So Luke chapter 1, first of all, this is at the very beginning. Luke tells us why he's sitting down to write what he writes. Many have undertaken to draw upon an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first, and underline this, they were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Luke comes right out of the chute and says, this is historical fact. Then he goes on to write, with this in mind, that it is an eyewitness account. And then he says, since I myself have carefully investigated everything, he is putting himself in the place of the detective. He's checked this out. He's putting his own reputation on the line and saying, I've carefully investigated everything from the beginning of what I'll be writing. I, too, decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. That's his who he's sending this letter to, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Theophilus is the one, just like we got these Bibles this fall, that got Luke and Acts as a companion two-volume set. He didn't get the rest of the New Testament. He just got those two because those are the work of Luke, a meticulous doctor, detective, and eyewitness to what Jesus taught, lived, and how he was resurrected. A wonderful gift to us today to have this account. But let's go to the other end of the bookend, the Gospel of John at the end in chapter 22, verses 24 and 25. I love his hyperbole. And John is concluding his gospel with these words. This is the disciple who testifies to these things. He's referring to himself and who wrote them down. He's putting his testimony on the line. We know that his testimony is true, speaking of Jesus. Jesus did many other things as well. And here's the hyperbole. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would have been written. When I first read this, back in my youth, I pictured long before digitized books. Now it could be on a microchip, but back then it would have had to have been in books in a library. And I pictured the biggest library I could imagine, which was the Seattle downtown library, full, not just of four accounts by different gospel writers, but entire library that contained the secrets of Jesus. The stuff that God, in his inspiration of this Bible we have, decided not to include. And so John and Luke are both saying, what we're writing is not fable. This is not mythology like the Greeks and the Romans have. And we're willing to put our own testimony, our reputation on the line. And just like many of the apologetics that support the resurrection of Jesus, when we come to the birth of Jesus, anyone could have denied the claims that both Luke and John made in their Gospels. They had people who were alive that could either give a thumbs up or thumbs down to what had been written, because more than those two people experienced it. I want to introduce you to a painter this morning. I'm sure when you woke up, you said, I sure hope he brings some art into the Christmas Eve service. Well, I'm going to do that. There's a picture of an African-American gentleman by the name of Henry Tanner, lived from 1859 to 1937. Any art history students in the house that would remember this gentleman or studied him? Didn't think so. I'd never heard of him. I'd known of one of his works that we'll look at in a minute, but as I did some research, he was really the first African-American painter to gain international acclaim at the turn of the century. He was the son of a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. That denomination still exists today, one of the first denominations that was based out of the African American community. And Tanner specialized in doing artwork in religious subjects. He traveled to Palestine in the Holy Land in 1897, long before the Jews had repopulated that and formed the nation of Israel in 1948. He's 50 years ahead of the time, but because of his interest in religious themes, he went to Palestine and saw many of the archaeological facts that are there today. Well, the painting I want to introduce to you this morning is perhaps his most famous, and it's the Annunciation of the Angel Gabriel to Mary. And there it is. If you look this up online, you can see the definition of the colors and the different lines that he uses in this painting. But in the early 1900s, this was very unconventional for religious art. If you look up most of the annunciations of Mary or any of the biblical accounts of Jesus' birth, what do you see? There's angels everywhere. Sometimes there's little cherub, chubby little faces that are peering into the manger. There's halos around Mary and Joseph and even the shepherds. The angels are in full regalia, just like our video this morning. Religious art was religious. And Tanner went against the grain of his current artistic displays and did something that's very plain. If you notice, he has painted a Palestinian lower-income teenager. She has no halo. She has no gown or anything that would signify that she is anything special. She is wearing the rumpled Middle Eastern peasant clothing. And her surroundings are very simple as she sits on the bed in this room. And if you look over to the left-hand side, it's lost a little bit, but there is simply a pillar of light that Tanner uses to show the angel Gabriel. Nothing more than the brilliance of the glory of how the Bible describes when the curtain of heaven is pulled back. And Luke records that this peasant girl's response is initially confusion. Luke writes that she was greatly troubled, she was fearful, and she was questioning. I guess so, if that was the kind of announcement that a teenage girl was to get. These were all natural responses to what was extravagant, otherworldly news. But I simply want to point out one other verse this morning. Note the end of the account of this annunciation with Gabriel. It's from Luke chapter 1 and verse 38. This is how Luke records Mary's response. Mary said, "Behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word." Amazing response from the lips and the heart of this teenage girl. Her confusion and her questioning is slowly being replaced by something that Christians call faith. In her young life, I would submit that she has obviously sought out the God of Israel. The scriptures that we call the Old Testament were the Bible of this time, and people could find out about the history of God and their country as a good Jew. And we learn throughout the scriptures that there are those who are called God-fearers, or those that whose hearts are open to God, some of them from the time they are little children. I could give literally countless examples, but we see it with Abraham. We see it with Moses. We see it with Samuel as a young boy. We see it with David as a young boy. We see it with Daniel throughout the Old Testament. And now we flip the page from the Old Testament to this new, and we find that there are still people who are open to the work of God. Elizabeth, this old woman, who is also told that she's going to expect a child. She responds with faith. Joseph responds with faith, even though he's confused about where this baby came from. And certainly Mary shows this. And so one way to look at faith in Jesus is that it's actually something that we receive more than conjuring up some belief system and giving that to God. Christians have believed, and the scriptures bear out, that faith is a gift that is given to those who are humble. It is given to those who seek and are wanting to find. It doesn't mean we can't question. It doesn't mean we can't doubt. But we continue to follow as Mary did and say, "Let it be to me according to your word." Even in the confusion of the beginning of this pregnancy. Let's shorten Mary's response to this. "Lord, let it be to me according to your word." I think Mary has given us a centering prayer. No matter where you're at in your own faith journey, this is the prayer of somebody who is saying, "I open myself to the faith that can come as a gift to me if I simply open up my heart to it." To be anxious and confused is to be human. The question is, what do we do with our anxieties? We can hang on to them. We can dwell on them. We can let them dictate our lives. And that, too, is human response. But there's something about the gospel of Jesus Christ that says we can begin to hand them over to someone else, and we do it by faith. A gift of faith that returns to us. Mary, in her teenage understanding of God, not fully developed, immature on some level, but she gives us a posture to pray this wonderful centering prayer, "Lord, let it be to me according to your word." She was entrusting herself to the one who is eternally trustworthy. Found a great quote from one of my favorite Catholic theologians, Richard John Niehaus. Died just a few years ago, but he's a very quotable guy if you want to look him up on the internet. "Faith does not deny the reason for anxiety, but it rejects the rule of anxiety." He's a very honest pastor. He realizes that we all carry anxieties, including those of us who are called clergy. But the question again is, will that anxiety rule you? Or will it be something whereas Mary's response, "Lord, let it be to me according to your word"? It's God's responsibility to fill that void with increasing faith because he's the one that's giving it as we bring our small measure to him. As we prepare for communion this morning, I want to fast forward 9 months from the time of the announcement of this coming of baby Jesus. The song we're going to hear is now 9 months later as Mary is holding this little baby in her arms. Thank you. Lord, let it be to me according to your word. I could do a whole message on the resurrection at this point, or the crucifixion rather, because the image that goes with this one is Mary holding the dead corpse of Jesus. Not a pretty picture on Christmas Eve, so I chose not to preach that one. But it's true, and on Good Friday, that's always the most moving part of the Good Friday service for me, is the other part of Mary's hopeful anticipation for what would happen, and now she sees the other side. But for our purposes this morning, we're coming to this table, and now it's a risen Lord who instituted this meal. I'm always impressed with the continuity from the gospel writers into the letters that we have as they taught and sought to mature these young churches. Put up this scripture from 2 Corinthians. This is the Apostle Paul writing to this new church in a city called Corinth. Let's read this together as our words of institution for communion today. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. That was Paul's reality as one who had turned his life over to follow the risen Lord. I invite you to bow your heads with me, and in this time of quiet, in this sanctuary, this safe place for you to speak to Jesus, I invite you to make your own prayer of confession this morning. This is a time for you to perhaps release anxieties that have beset you this past year. A time for you to say, "Lord, let it be to me according to your word." Would you pray your own prayers of confession now in silence?